WMFO Medford. Well, good afternoon, everyone. And it is gorgeous, beautiful, very low humidity, if hardly any, a nice breeze. What more could you ask for? Just delicious, especially after that heat wave. Somebody out there likes that heat wave, I know that. But for moi, 70s, low humidity, perfect. So this is the Voicemobile here at WMFO Medford at Tufts University. And I'm your host, Joyce the Voice. Happy to be here. And I got a nice mocha frap downstairs at the Brown and Brew. And they will be open till August. As you know probably by now, that Curtis Hall is undergoing certain renovations. And after August, the Brown and Brew is going to be moved down to a new building on the same side, but down the hill. And we'll see. I don't think the WMFO is moving. I haven't heard anything about that. But happily, now with the construction somewhat completed, there's some parking finally. It's been really rough. Anyhow, blah, blah, blah. want to share something that might be useful for you. Local farmers markets. Throughout the summer and early autumn, there are a number of local farmers markets where you can buy fresh Massachusetts-grown vegetables, fruits, berries, herbs, flowers, honey, and even baked goods. Medford Farmers Market takes place every Thursday from 3 to 7 in the Condon Shell on Mystic Valley Parkway in Medford, with free parking in the lot there, as well as on both sides of Winthrop and South Streets. The Somerville Davis Square Farmers Market is open Wednesdays from noon through 6 in the hot in the lot at Day and Herbert Streets. On the other side of Somerville's, Union Square hosts its Farmers Market on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. right in Union Square Plaza. Cambridge, Arlington, Boston, and many other cities and towns have their own markets as well. For more info, just fire up your favorite internet search engine and look for the farmers market in your area. I know that the Belmont Farmers Market opens, it's on Thursdays. So I think it might be from 3 to 6, or I'm not exactly sure what the hours are, but that's another great market. It's a public service message from all the fruits and vegetables here at WMFO in Medford Tufts Community Radio. That's so cute. Alrighty, so let me see if there's anything else I want to share with you before we get going with some music. I'm looking at the Brattle Theater schedule, and let's see what's coming up. In there's May, we want June, and okay, Seven Beauties, the films of Alina Wertmüller. So they're screening on tonight, Ferdinando and Carolina. That's an 8 o'clock showing. And The Seven Beauties is an 8:30 p.m. showing on Thursday. And Jonathan Safran Foer, that's at the Harvard Bookstore at 6 p.m. And then on the weekend, All About the Chase, Freebie and the Bean, The French Connection, those are on Friday. Vanishing Point, Gone in 60 Seconds, and New York Dog Film Festival, a special event. So that's all happening over at the Brattle Theater. And I guess that's good. So we have something very, very special. I'm looking forward to sharing this with you. This is a CD version of Les Liaisons Dangereuses from 1960. This is Thelonious Monk's never-before-released Monk studio recording for Roger Vadim's famed French film of the same name. It's a double CD featuring Monk's 1959 All-Star Working Band, Charlie Roos, Sam Jones, and Art Taylor, plus special guest French saxophonist Barney Willen. That's going to be released on June 16th via Sam Recording / Saga. The LP version was released in April for Record Store Day. As you know, 2017 marks Thelonious Monk's centennial. Monk was at the height of his powers when he entered Nola Penthouse Studios in New York City on July 27, 1959, to record several of his best-known compositions for use as the predominant soundtrack of the film. Never before had Monk recorded music to be used in a film. As monk biographer Robin D. G. Kelly notes, quote, it is not too much to suggest that Monk transformed what would have been an edgy but relative standard narrative film into an avant-garde cinema. T.S. Monk says, this is a marvelous release. Thelonious is at his best with a wonderful array of his best friends, including the folks that I just mentioned, Charlie Roos, Sam Jones, and Art Taylor. The entire Monk family is delighted to partner with Sam Records Saga to make this release possible. The project includes a 56-page booklet with original artwork by Jerome Witz, essays by acclaimed jazz writers Robin D.J. Kelly, Brian Presley, and Alan Tersenet, as well as a complete discography compiled by Daniel Richard, plus never-before-published color and black-and-white photographs and memorabilia from the recording session. Quite amazing. I'll tell you more about this project as we get into it, but this is quite a treat. Thank you. That is just exquisite. Let me just tell you, in case you don't know, that was the Thelonious Monk Quintet. Charlie Roos on tenor, Barley Willen on tenor, Thelonious Monk on piano, Sam Jones on double bass, and Art Taylor on drums. Just absolutely amazing. This was recorded at the NOLA Penthouse Sound Studios in New York, July 27th, 1959. And this was for the film, Roger Vadim's famed French film, Les Liaisons Dangereuses. And the story about how this came to be, we have producer Zev Feldman writing, in December of 2014, I was visiting Paris and received a very charming introductory email out of the blue from the head of SAM Records, Mr. Fred Thomas, explaining that he and his friend, Mr. François Lejoin of Saga Jazz, producer of the acclaimed Jazz in Paris series, had located master tapes of a previously unissued studio session of Thelonious Monk, made in 1959 by a French producer, the one and only Marcel Romano, Miles Davis, Ascenseur pour l'Echauffeau. I was obviously extremely intrigued, and I believe my eyeballs literally left my face upon reading the news. Are you kidding me? A studio album? This was an extraordinary find, and I wanted to know more. We would meet up several days later at the Café de l'Olympia over coffee, where we got to know each other and discuss this extraordinary find. Fred and Francois were looking for a partner and needed someone who knew the Monk family and was a fellow kindred spirit who shared a passion to present this find in a presentation worthy of a giant. I was honored. They were familiar with my work, and I thought I would be a good fit and collaborator. As we spoke at the cafe, it became clear we were all three guys cut from the same cloth who loved jazz, an international language in itself. Over the next 2 years, we worked with the Thelonious Monk Estate and set out to assemble the cast of voices, words, and photos to bring together and tell the story of this amazing event in Thelonious Monk's recorded legacy. It just might be one of the greatest journeys and highlights of my life. I'd like to thank the Thelonious Monk Estate for making this project possible, especially T.S. Monk and Gail Monk. I'd also like to thank the rest of the Monk team, including Thelonious Monk's grandchildren, Sierra Monk and Thelonious Monk IV, plus Team Monk's Denise Pruitt Grant and Julien Saint-Hill. Finally, I'd like to thank my co-producers, Fred Thomas and François Lejoin, for inviting me on this journey, which I will never forget. Wow. So that is very exciting. We'll be playing more from that for sure. Before I get into the next selection, I want to share something from the Algeminer. This is an article written by Alan Dershowitz, A New Tolerance for Anti-Semitism. This was originally published by the Gatestone Institute. All over the world, anti-Semites are becoming mainstreamed. It is no longer disqualifying to be outed as a Jew hater. This is especially so if the anti-Semite uses the cover of rabid hatred for the nation state of the Jewish people. These bigots succeed in becoming accepted, even praised, not because of their anti-Semitism, but despite it. Increasingly, they are given a pass on their Jew hatred because those who support them admire or share other aspects of what they represent. This implicit tolerance of anti-Semitism, as long as it comes from someone whose other views are acceptable, represents a dangerous new trend from both the right and the left. In the United States, the Trump election has brought hard right anti-Semitism into public view, but the bigotry of the hard left is far more prevalent and influential on many university campuses. Those on the left who support left-wing anti-Semites try to downplay, ignore, deny that those they support are really anti-Semites. Quote, they are anti-Zionists is the excuse du jour. Those on the right do essentially the same, saying, quote, they are nationalists. Neither side would accept such transparent and hollow justifications if the shoe were on the other foot. I believe that when analyzing and exposing these dangerous trends, A single standard of criticism must be directed at each. Generally speaking, extreme right-wing anti-Semitism continues to be a problem in many parts of Europe and among a relatively small group of alt-right Americans. But it also exists among those who self-identify as run-of-the-mill conservatives. Consider, for example, former presidential candidate and Reagan staffer Pat Buchanan. The list of Buchanan's anti-Jewish bigotry is exhaustive. Over the years, he has consistently blamed Jews for wide-ranging societal and political problems. In his criticism of the Iraq War, for example, Buchanan infamously quipped, "There are only two groups that are beating the drums for war in the Middle East, the Israeli Defense Ministry and its Amen Corner in the United States." He then singled out for rebuke only Jewish political figures and commentators such as Henry Kissinger, Charles Krauthammer, and A.M. Rosenthal. He did not mention any of the vocal non-Jewish supporters of the war. Furthermore, Buchanan also said that, quote, the Israeli lobby, unquote, would be responsible if President Obama decided to strike Iran, threatening that if it were to happen, quote, Netanyahu and his Amen Corner in Congress would face backlash worldwide, unquote. Buchanan's sordid flirtation with Nazi revisionism is also well documented. Meanwhile, on university campuses, the absurd concept of, quote, intersectionality, unquote, which has become a code word for anti-Semitism, is dominating discussions and actions by the hard left. The warm embrace of Palestinian-American activist Linda Sarsour, who recently delivered the commencement address at a City University of New York graduation, is a case in point. Since co-organizing the Women's March on Washington in January, Sarsour has become a feminist icon for so-called, quote, progressives, unquote. This is the same Linda Sarsour who has said that feminism and Zionism are incompatible, stating, quote, you either stand up for the rights of all women, including Palestinians, or none. There's just no way around it, unquote. And when speaking about two leading female anti-Islamists, Brigitte Gabrielle and Ayan Hirsi Ali, who is the victim of female genital mutilation, the feminist du jour, Linda Sarsour, said, quote, I wish I could take away their vaginas, unquote. Ooh, sick. The irony is palpable. Under her own all-or-nothing criteria, Sarsour, who is also a staunch BDS supporter, cannot be pro-Palestinian and a feminist because the Palestinian Authority and Hamas subjugate women and treat gays far worse than Israel does. Indeed. Sarsour has emerged as a champion of the hard left. Both New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio and Bernie Sanders have sought her endorsement. Moreover, Deputy DNC Chair Keith Ellison, who himself has a sordid history with anti-Semitism, stemming from his association with Louis Farrakhan, a man who has publicly boasted about his own Jew hatred, has come out in support of the bigoted Sarsour. When it comes to Ellison, an old idiom comes to mind. A man is known by the company he keeps. The same trend is detectable among the hard left in Europe, particularly in Britain, which is days away from an election. The British Labour Party has now been hijacked by radical extremists on the left and is known for being soft on anti-Semitism. In a recent interview with a BBC reporter, Emma Barrett, who happens to be Jewish, Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn fumbled when answering a question about how much his proposed childcare policy would cost. Rather than critique Corbyn, Labour supporters viciously trolled the Jewish BBC reporter. Tweets such as these abounded. Quote, allegations have surfaced that at Emma Barrett is a Zionist, unquote, and Zionist Emma Barnett, family lived off brothels, attacks Jeremy Corbyn. Oof, really bad. Corbyn has also been accused of anti-Jewish bigotry himself. He has said in the past that the genocidal Hamas terrorist group should be removed from the UK's designated terror list and has called Hezbollah and Hamas, which are both vowed to the destruction of the nation state of the Jewish people, my friends. I recently wrote extensively on Corbyn's association with some of Britain's most notorious Holocaust deniers and anti-Semites. Increasingly, anti-Semitic discourse is also seeping into the arts and academia. Consider the anti-Israel and anti-Jewish bigotry of former Pink Floyd bassist Roger Waters. A staunch supporter of the so-called BDS movement, Waters has said about the Palestinians that, quote, parallels with what went on in the 30s in Germany are so crushingly obvious, unquote. He also had a pig-shaped balloon with the Star of David on it at one of his concerts. When asked about his aggressive effort to recruit people to join the BDS movement, Waters blamed, quote, the Jewish lobby, which he explained is, quote, extraordinarily powerful here, and particularly in the industry that I work in, the music industry, unquote. In 2013, the ADL declared that, quote, anti-Semitic conspiracy theories had, quote, seeped into the totality of Waters' views. Likewise, the marketplace of ideas on college campuses and within academic institutions has seen an embrace of anti-Semitism, often disguised as anti-Zionism. Several years ago, I identified the dangerous trend of academics crossing a red line between acceptable criticism of Israel and legitimizing Jew hatred. This was in light of the disgraceful endorsement by a number of prominent academics of an anti-Semitic book written by Gilad Arzmon, a notorious Jew hater who denies the Holocaust and attributed widespread economics troubles to a, quote, Zio punch, unquote. When asked recently about the hullabaloo surrounding her CUNY address, Linda Sarsour disingenuously played the victim card, saying, quote, since the Women's March on Washington, once the right wing saw a very prominent Muslim American woman in a hijab who was a Palestinian who was resonating with the community in a very large way, they made it their mission to do everything they can to take my platform away, unquote. No, Ms. Sarsour, you are wrong. This is not a smear campaign by the, quote, right wing, but rather a show that people of goodwill reject your manifestations of bigotry. Those who tolerate anti-Semitism from those they otherwise admire would never accept other forms of bigotry, such as racism, sexism, or homophobia. It's difficult to imagine Bernie Sanders campaigning for a socialist who didn't like black people or who was against gay marriage, but he is comfortable campaigning for Jeremy Corbyn, who has made a career out of condemning Zionists, by which he means Jews. The growing tolerance for anti-Semitism by both the extreme left and right is quickly becoming mainstream. That is why it is so dangerous and must be exposed for what it is, complicity in and encouragement of the oldest form of bigotry. Shame on those who tolerate anti-Semitism when it comes from their side of the political spectrum. People on both sides of the aisle must have the same zero tolerance for anti-Semitism as they do for sexism, racism, and homophobia. Decent people everywhere, Jews and non-Jews, must condemn with equal vigor all manifestations of bigotry, whether they emanate from the hard alt-right or hard alt-left. I will continue to judge individuals on the basis of their own statements and actions, regardless of which side of the aisle they come from. Alan M. Dershowitz is the Felix Frankfurter Professor of Law Emeritus at Harvard Law School and author of Taking the Stand, My Life in the Law and Erectile Dysfunction, A Guide for the Unaroused Voter. Oh, my. You can follow him on Twitter at Alan Dersh, D-E-R-S-H, and Facebook. Well, there it is. Quite the article. All right, so let's go back to some music here on the voicemobile at WMFO. Thank you. Oh, that was quite lovely. Let's see what we have as far as information on that. I really enjoyed that. Okay. Second act. Guitarist composer Alex Goodman opens a new chapter featuring a stellar band of next generation jazz voices on second act. This fifth album, due out June 23rd on Light Records, the Toronto native stakes his claim on the New York City jazz scene alongside Matt Marantz, Eden Ledden, Rick Rosato, and Jimmy McBride. Several different quotes. Excellent technique, a full, rich guitar tone, and a definite, unique musical voice. That's from Vince Lewis from Guitar International. And here's a quote from the Birmingham Times. Goodman has acquired a signature style that's definitely like no other, a jazz phenomenon the world over. And from Glenn Astarita, all about jazz, shuns convention while merging disparate forces into a harmonious union. Says after 5 years in New York City, Alex Goodman has not only established himself as a rising star and significant voice in the jazz mecca, but has gathered together a gifted group of peers, each of whom are quickly forging a path forward for the music's next generation. Guitarist composer began his career in his native Toronto, becoming an integral part of the scene in the Canadian city and receiving a wealth of accolades across the country. The CBC News hailed him as having, quote, taken the jazz world by storm and attained a level of fame and success in the insular jazz community that few other Canadian guitarists can match. In 2014, he received international recognition, winning both first prize and the Public's Choice Award at the Montreux Jazz Festival International Guitar Competition in Switzerland. And there's lots more on here, but we'll share that other times. Again, the folks on this, saxophonist Matt Marantz from Texas, pianist Eden Ledden, born in New York City but raised in Israel, bassist Rick Rosato, Montreal, and drummer Jimmy McBride from Connecticut. So it says they've each formed relationships with such envelope-pushing artists as Avishai Cohen, Will Vinson, Lage Lund, Nir Felder, Terrence Blanchard, and Jonathan Batiste, while working together in a variety of settings, spurring each other onward into exciting new territory. Well, I think that was quite wonderful. Oh, mentioned Jane Monahite, that he's performed with him, Charles Lloyd, Ari Honig, Ben Wolf, John Ellis, John Riley. It's amazing. When you start to see the pedigrees of all these different folks, it's really astounding. So I think I'm going to go back to the second cut on this wonderful Thelonious Monk CD. Enjoy. Thank you.
Thank you. call it magic, call it true, call it magic, when I'm with you, and I just got broken, broken into two. Still I call it magic when I'm next to you. And I don't. I know I don't, it's true. I don't want anybody else but you. I don't, it's true. I don't want anybody else but you. Call it magic, cut me into two. A precious jewel. And I don't, it's true, I don't know, want anybody else but you. I don't, it's true, I don't know, want anybody else but you. I wanna fall so far. Magic when I'm next to you. Must have been moon glow, way up in the blue. It must have been moon glow that led me straight to you. I still hear you saying, dear one, hold me fast, while I start in praying. Oh Lord, let this thing last. Way up in the